on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's time for Jaws of Justice.
It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's show, host Craig Lubow talks with Sister Simone Campbell, one of the sisters on the bus. Sister Simone speaks about the nuns' efforts to affect public policy on social and economic justice issues that are informed by their faith and common sense through their group, Network Lobby. Today's interview is a bit longer than usual, but be sure to have your pencils and paper ready for our calendar later in the show, and don't forget the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Up next is Craig and his guest, Sister Simone Campbell.
Hey, this is Craig Lubow, and thank you for joining us on Jaws of Justice. Today I have Sister Simone Campbell. She is the author of A Nun on the Bus, and she is with National Catholic Social Justice Lobby, which is part of Network. And we are going to be talking about economic justice and other forms of justice. Welcome, Simone. Why did you write that book?
Well, I wrote the book because I'm really concerned about our nation and the fact that as we've traveled around the country, I've seen people who are so hungry for community and feel so isolated, so alone. And so the folks at Harper came to me and they said, well, would you write a book about your experience, your story, what you're worried about? And so as I call my spirituality walking willing, and since Harper asked, I was willing. And it was really the effort to tell the story of what happened in our Nuns on the Bus trip in 2012, 2013, and how all of this goes together in this moment in our nation to reclaim community. It is an unpatriotic lie that we're based in individualism. And many politicians want to sell us this idea that we're just individuals. But we all know from the Constitution that that's wrong. It's we the people. It's all of us together. And if we stand together, then we don't have to be fearful. We don't have to be afraid of each other, that we can come together and create community. And that's the part that I want to nourish, a community that does democracy.
Okay. And you spoke at a church gathering on August 7th, and you did a kind of a graph about economics, and I know this isn't video, but maybe you can
try to lay a
visual and what that was about.
Well, we do what we call a human bar graph. Now your listeners will know that a bar graph is just, you know, those lines that show differences among different classifications. So what we try to do is do a human bar graph on a change in income for the different quintiles, the 20% of our society over the last 30 years. And what the people need to know is that between 1949 and 1979, everybody's income went up about 100%. So everybody participated in the growth of the economy. But between 1980 and 2009, it's a really different story. And so what I do is get five people up there and give them, each gets assigned, one's the top 20%, and then you get the next, and then you get the middle class, and then the ones, you know, below that, and then the bottom 20%. And I have them come, and we make an axis, and so they stand, and for every 5% change in their income, then they get to take one step. So the top 20% income went up 50% in this period of time from 1980 to 2009. So last night it was Ashton, and in August it was Ashton, and so she gets to take 10 steps. So she's out there. And then the next comes up, and the next to the highest only went up 23%. So he gets 4.5 steps. The middle class's income in those 11 years only went up 11, I mean in those 30 years, only went up 11%. And so he only gets to take 2 steps. And then the next to the bottom only went up 4%. So he gets to take 1 step. But the bottom, the folks who are struggling the hardest in our economy, in our society, lost ground in 30 years. Where in the 30 years before that, everybody had gone up 100%. Actually, the bottom had gone up 116%. So he takes a step and a half back. So you get this line of people stretched out. But then what we do is break out the top 20%. This is where it gets shocking. Because the top 5%, which includes members of Congress, by definition, because it's $200,000 or more, then they get to take 15 and a half steps. And then you get what person, so that person's way out there ahead of the pack. But then you get the top 1%. And they went up, I think it's 243%. So they get 45 steps. And they end up so far away from everybody else. And this is the trouble in our nation. The folks that have the money, the percolating of money to the top, is for these folks that are so far away from seeing the rest of us. So they don't know the lived experience of most of us, because these folks at the top, so far away, what happens? They live in gated communities. They have private jets. They don't know the joy of flying on Southwest Airlines and other low-cost carriers. They don't know, they don't send their kids to public schools, so they're not invested in the public school system. They, have drivers, so they don't worry about roads so much. They do not, the ones with the cash, don't share the common wheel. And so they don't know our experience. That's the trouble. And so when you see that the middle class, the bottom 60% are really clustered together, and you see that they don't understand what's happening way up there. They just know they don't have enough. And then you get the stories of the individuals at the different levels. And so it's really a dramatic, dramatic picture.
When you talk to people at the higher end,
yep.
Do you get the sense that they just aren't connected and they don't understand the lower end, or do you get the sense they really just don't care? They have it and they don't care.
Well, there's probably some people that don't care, but the folks that I've talked to are either oblivious, they don't know the reality, or some folks at the top know the reality and are trying to share and change that. And then I had this guy, Tom, who for the first bus trip, he read about me in the New York Times, so he just drops by the office and offers to pay for the gas for the bus. So he gives a check right then for $10,000 because he really cares about what's happening. He's a head of a construction company. And then after the bus trip, he took me out to lunch, and he was talking. He said, well, don't give us at the top too hard of a time, because, I'm working hard to make jobs for my people. I know my people. And he showed me his construction site. He does commercial contracting. And so, he does know his people. He's making jobs. He is making a difference. So not everybody is just oblivious. He's trying to pay, reasonable wages, but not everybody is. And the other piece that happens is those that make most of their wealth through investing in companies, they don't have the personal stories. They don't know the struggles of people. They just invest. They have their market plan or whatever, and so they're invested in the market. That's disconnected from people. And when you're disconnected from people, then you don't know the story. And that's the big difference. I think the challenge is for everybody to be connected to each other so we understand something bigger than ourselves.
So what are some of the things that you believe we can do to bring that community together so that people at the upper end would be connected?
Well, one of the things I advocate, half tongue-in-cheek, is that if those of us at the bottom are having a really good time and we let them know about it, they're lonesome up there, so invite them into the party. Come join us. You don't have to be out there by yourself. Come join us. But there's some specific policies that created this, because it wasn't always this way, and so our policies have to be reshaped for that. There are several that I talk about. One of the hard parts is that wages have been flat for a very long time, for this 30-year period. And so what we need to do is we need to make sure that wages are increased. The best way to make sure that wages are increased is to support labor organizing, to support unions. Now, people can say unions are corrupt. Yeah, unions are corrupt, but hey, we're human. And as a Catholic, I believe we're all kind of subject to, the human condition. But what happens is that with union organizing, businesses get better, because then you get business at the table with the management at the table with labor, and you get folks trying to improve their whole business together. You get cooperation. And then shared profits. I mean, that makes sense to me. The folks that are making the profits for the top should participate in it. So wages are a big thing. I think we really need to raise the minimum wage. The fact that it's been stagnant all these years is wrong. Then once it's raised, then we need to index it so we don't have this fight all the time. People should participate in the benefit of their work. It's good Catholic social teaching, and it also makes good economic sense. Put money in the hands of those where there's pent-up demand. It will grow the economy. So that's one easy one. A second one is the issues of taxation. We need reasonable revenue for responsible programs. And what that means is we have to have reasonable tax revenue. And we've got to get over this idea that taxes are this burden. Oh, woe is me. Taxes are a burden. No, they're not. They're how we invest in our society. This is how we prepare for the future. Our grandparents invested their tax dollars into our society, so we're benefiting from this great country of ours. But what we have to do is to do the same thing for the next generation. And we're not doing a very good job right now. We, the people, need to invest our money. So at our little organization network, this coming April, we're going to have our second annual Taxpayer Pride Day, where we invite people to send in selfies, you know, pictures of yourself and your favorite government service. And why are you proud to pay taxes? We want to change the conversation so it's not, oh, it's a burden, it's April 15th. No, this is how we invest in our democracy. Let's claim it. Let's own it. Let's be grateful that we live in this amazing nation. So it's that kind of tax policy that can make a difference. Things like inheritance tax can make a huge difference. Things like how we have progressive taxes, meaning those at the bottom pay what they're able, but those at the top who are benefiting most should pay the most. And currently they're not. So we have to do tax policy that feeds that. Another policy that's really important is our housing policy, because many people in the economic crash, you know, lost their homes. I don't know the story here in Kansas City so much, but I've been in a lot of communities where the foreclosure rate was really high, where people, you know, neighborhoods are just blighted. And what we have to do is redo our housing policy so that everybody has a place to live. Our faith teaches that the minimum expectation is that everybody should have access to live in dignity. Everybody should have access to food, shelter, clothing, health care, and education. And shelter, we're not doing too good of a job of that right now. So that's another area where we see could make a huge difference in shifting the economics.
When we talk about raising wages, what can we do to convince the corporations that raising wages is going to make the corporation more prosperous as well as the individual?
I know. Isn't that amazing?
And I'll tell you one of the things I'm thinking of in the background is what Robert Kennedy said in the speech. I'm talking about Robert Kennedy Jr., obviously, when he was here last September. And that is that the very structure, the way the structure is set up of corporations, it makes that hard to do because legally their first obligation as a fiduciary capacity is to keep increasing dividends that go to the shareholders.
Well, but here's the deal. That's how we have most recently defined it. That wasn't always the case. What corporations used to see was that they had not just the responsibility to get money to the shareholder. That's a recent phenomenon where somehow this idea we ought to get a profit out as quickly as we can and this return on investment is a new phenomenon that is sapping our economy, I believe, because we no longer have a long term. You can't run. I ran a law center for 18 years. I started it and ran it, so I know what being an entrepreneur is about. But you got to look for the long haul. You have to have a business plan that's for the long haul. If you suck all your profits out in one quarter, you're going to be cut short down the road, or you're going to squeeze everybody because you're frantic that you got to show a 1 cent gain. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's our expectations that corporations should get all this money that is the problem. So if we're trying to change our cultural conversation so that what's referred to now as the triple bottom line, so that yes, they're profitable, but they don't have to squeeze every dime out at the price of their workers. Because if you look at it, money is only one measure. The second is, are you a good community? Is part of your bottom line doing good in the community and for your workers? Do the people of our society do better? So that's another measure of profitability. And the third is, are you doing good by the environment? And unless we look at, yeah, money's a piece of it, but it's also how the justice for the community and the care of the earth, those are the three measures that we have to make sure that in our psyche as a society, that we begin to say, this is how we measure corporations. It's not just money, because we know there's more to life than money. And we like to say, oh, we're, you know, a faithful nation and all this stuff. Well, if we're a faithful nation, we know there's more than money. There's meaning. And how are we in relationship? So I'm pushing the triple bottom line and that we recover who we were.
And I'd like to kind of relate a little bit of how we grow the economy and be prosperous so people can get out of poverty.
Right.
And yet balance that with a... Well, in some countries, a shrinking population and family planning and stuff. In some countries now are beginning to, they're at the replacement rate, they're slightly below it.
Japan, but France, a few others.
And, but there's some that argue that because of that, the that you have to keep growing the population in order to grow the economy.
Oh, that's wrong. What we need is, and what the U.S. has relied upon, is immigration. And that's why we're different from a bunch of northern tier countries, why we're different from Europe, why we're different from Japan, is that we've relied on immigration to keep us young and to keep us innovative. Now, one of the things about our nation that people don't think about is that it's all the adventurers who have come from these other countries, countries of origins. These risk takers have come here for the hope of creating something new. And so they're the ones that have kept innovation alive in our society. One-fourth of all new businesses are started by immigrants. So they're the ones that keep the economy going. Now, there is a design defect in all of this that I worry about, and that is just orienting our society, our economy, around consumption is not a great long-term plan, because we've got to find, I think what we need to do is shift from this idea of economic growth to economic sustainability. And so creating a sustainable economy that creates an equilibrium so that everybody can participate in the global reality, because it's a global economy, so what we've got to look at is how do we deal globally with equitable access to resources. But the other piece is we can't suck everything out of the earth in our generation. And they say tough for the folks that come after us. So we've got to find a new equilibrium that creates a balance. And that's where I think the new growth edge is. So yes, we need innovation. Yes, we need youth. Oh, it'll all balance out. When I was in college, I studied issues of family planning and all this. And, you know, in rural societies, the single biggest, best way to reduce childbirth was to introduce electricity because it gave people options for nighttime activity. So there's a lot of things. It's a great complex situation, but I think we do find balance. But the hard part for us is going to be shifting to an economy of sustainability, not just an economy of consumption.
That was interesting what you said about the with electricity.
I know, isn't that great?
I don't recall, this was a few years back, probably longer than I'm thinking, but when they had the blackout on the East Coast.
There was a baby boom,
and
right?
It was a baby
9 months
boom,
later.
But yeah.
Proves my statistic.
Now, you talked about immigration stuff. Where do you see us headed on that?
Oh.
And what can we do? I did just have, by the way, August 5th, I had a show. I do Radioactive Magazine here, too,
mm-hmm.
And the entire show is on immigration with four immigration attorneys
and an activist.
And they're going to come back and do a second show on October 28th.
Oh, wonderful. That's good. That's good. Well, I think the heartbreak of this reality is that the... as a legislative issue, Speaker Boehner in the Congress says he's not bringing it up, which is really heartbreak because we've got the votes for an okay bill that could be conferenced with the Senate bill. Some people are holding out hope that after the November election there might be something, but I don't think that's happening. I think what we have to do is we have to keep pushing. We have to make immigration reform a issue in this election. We have to make sure that the folks that we elect to Congress are committed to comprehensive immigration reform that includes earned path to citizenship for folks in our nation. What people are in the rhetoric, there's a very small percentage that are frightened and fearful of immigrants, and it's mostly their anger, their fear. And we just have to be reasonable. It's not an educated response, except for the Native Americans. We are all children of immigrants, and we need the immigrants. And that's why white folks have come, why folks have overstayed their visas, is because they were hungry, and they needed hope. And most folks came here for opportunity and are contributing to our society. So that's the piece that we have to wrap our arms around. In the meantime, President Obama has said that he's going to do additional administrative relief because Congress isn't dealing with it. We're encouraging the president to do as much as he can because people are suffering. Our communities are being torn apart, and people are being exploited. One of the things people don't realize is that undocumented immigrants who are doing this work are here because there's work to be done, and we don't have a system that works. There's like 5,000 for the whole nation, 5,000 non-professional visas for folks who are not skilled, unskilled visas, when there is a demand for like 250,000 in our nation for things like gardening and demolition and, you know, simple construction stuff and nannies. And I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that these undocumented folks do, but there's only 5,000 visas for them. Well, 5,000 families could have, you know, help, but there's 250,000 out there that want it. So that's why people are here. So what we have to do is get our law in line with folks that are with the needs of our economy. The Senate had a good proposal. We didn't agree with everything in it. That's natural, but it was pretty good. It dealt with these things and dealt with what we call future flow. How do we decide who comes in based on the economy and the needs of family? And their proposal there was that there be a panel that would just look at the needs of our country and set those numbers, I think it was every 3 years, so that there'd be some predictability. That's the piece we've got to wrap our arms around. So
I know when I went to Costa Rica, one of the things I learned relating to immigration down there, because they have a similar issue, but the way they dealt with it is they allow people from Nicaragua to go into Costa Rica to take certain types of jobs that they don't have enough Costa Ricans to fill. But they don't get to move there. They come down there, they drive there every day, and then they drive back home, and they still live in Nicaragua.
Well, that's good if you're right along the border, you live in a small country. But for us, this would be problems, because I met a whole bunch of people up in Minnesota, and I don't think they could commute every day.
No, I'm thinking like Texas and Arizona, maybe.
Well, you know what? That used to be the way it was, because until we built this wall and we got all obsessed with it in September 11th. One of the things people don't realize, because we've gotten so obsessed with immigration and passing through our southern border, that folks that used to go back and forth all the time, they don't do that anymore because it's just too much of a hassle. Last year we were on a bus in doing our Nuns on the Bus, and we were in Nogales. And what people don't know is Nogales is one town, half on the Mexico side, half on the U.S. side. They have two mayors. They have the U.S. mayor, they have the Mexico mayor. So we were on the U.S. side, and they ran the wall right through town down the main road. And so half's on the U.S. side, half's on the Mexico side. And the mayor from the Mexico side wanted to come and greet us. Well, here's the mayor. He crosses regularly. He got caught in some thing, he couldn't get across the border. So he never made it to our event. He called on his cell phone saying, sorry, I'm stuck here at the border. So the people used to go back and forth that way. It's our obsession, our ridiculous obsession, that has created this impossibility. So I'm in favor of your plan for along the border. That's how San Diego was. That's how all those border towns, Calexico, all along. But not anymore.
Okay. You talked about last night the Medicaid issue.
Oh, yes. You all have trouble in River City.
So apparently you favor the expansion of Medicaid.
Yes.
Are you favoring that for everybody, or are you favoring a plan more like what we have with the Obamacare?
Well, I have a Catholic sister, so part of our Catholic social teaching is that everyone has a right to health care. Everyone. And in the richest nation on earth, it is shocking that not everyone has access to health care in our nation. But right now, the Affordable Care Act, called Obamacare, is the best step that we've got forward. And so while it doesn't get everybody in, it gets most people in. And the way it gets the folks at the lower income in is by Medicaid expansion. And the fact that Missouri and Kansas have not expanded Medicaid is harmful to their people. It's harmful to the economy. I mean, a lot of people may not take the basic human dignity argument that everybody has a right to live a healthy life. But if you don't take that argument, then maybe you'll take the economic argument that it gets a lot of money into your state. And that money gets spent by other folks. So that money goes to doctors, which then goes into the community. Money goes to other healthcare professionals like nurses' aides, folks in hospital settings, all of that. But the other piece that people need to know is that if you don't expand Medicaid, your money that comes from the federal government to serve the uninsured in your emergency hospitals, that money is being automatically reduced by the law. Because the expectation is that Medicaid will get more people covered, so the need for these payments to cover the uninsured goes down. So your state is going to be in the position of losing money to serve the uninsured while not decreasing the number of uninsured. It doesn't make economic sense. And I think a lot of this is just political anger and fear. And so what we have to do as a person of faith, I say, fear not. Get over it. Take care of our people. That's what we're about.
How do we get the message through to the mass of people? Back when Jay Leno was still doing the Tonight Show, this was like maybe not even more than a year ago, he was out on the street and they're asking people, do you favor Affordable Care Act? And then the other question, do you favor Obamacare? And more than half of the people did not understand it was
the same thing.
They wanted the Affordable Care Act and they wanted the health care reform, but they didn't want Obamacare.
I know, which I think is, an indictment on our nation for several reasons. One is the lack of intelligence. You know, and the Greeks who started democracy said that a democracy requires an educated populace and the capacity to have dialogue. That's what democracy requires. So we got to wake our people up. That's what I try to do. And then the second piece is it also evidences a political intransigence where it's about politics. It's about the name of the politician. It's not about the reality. And so if you care about people, then you've got to be concerned that they don't have access to health care. If you care about yourself, it's a little worrisome that somebody sitting next to you, you know, at a show or on a bus or, you know, at work, doesn't have access to health care because germs don't ask, do you have health insurance before I infect you? I mean, the fact is, it's a public health issue. And we're seeing with the Ebola outbreak, which hopefully gets contained soon, but now there is one virulent bug, but it affects everybody. There's no guarantees who it's going to affect. So it's a public health issue.
And so
it's common sense.
And so
everybody
if somebody's at the lower end, the income scale is infected with something like that, then public interest
to get them over it.
So that we don't have an epidemic.
Exactly. Whereas the other piece, another piece in terms of the labor side of things, is we really have an incentive to have, especially people in the food industry, to have paid time off, paid sick time. Because you don't want people feeling compelled to go to work when they don't feel well because they have to make a paycheck. And some of these fast food industries where there is no paid sick leave, you get up, you know, people coughing and sneezing and fixing your food. That's a design defect right there. So there's a lot that we can do to make our nation healthier. But one of them is expanding Medicaid to make sure that folks at the lower end get the care they need. It's a benefit for all of us, the 100% benefit. But the other piece that we're finding is when people get health care for chronic diseases, it cuts down on costs overall. If your diabetes is in control, that's great. Then you don't have hospitalizations, you don't have all the other collateral illnesses that you wrestle with diabetes. It just makes sense. It makes sense. So I hope sanity prevails.
You talked about when you wanted to have a smiley, and then again last night, about your conferences with Paul Ryan.
Yes. My friend, Congressman Ryan.
Now, I'm kind of skeptical about whether you're getting through to him.
So am I, but I'll keep at it. I'll keep trying.
Because just within the last week or two, I saw on the news, I forget what report it was, what station, but the Republicans just came out with a proposal to eliminate the earned income credit for the bottom two-thirds of the nation, while increasing, and they want to do that to pay for a tax cut for anybody earning more than $160,000.
I didn't see that one. But Paul Ryan actually says he is strongly in favor of the earned income tax credit. So that piece I see. That may have been at the state level. I don't know that that was the federal level. But I wouldn't be surprised. It's political season. A lot of these comments get stated for political reasons, not actual policy. And so we're coming up on the November election, so I expect a lot of outrageous activity. Yeah, in the midterm elections, where there's not a presidential election, not as many people pay attention. And so what the politicians try to do is stir up their base, and their base is more extreme than actual policy. And so a comment like that, it wouldn't go anyplace. So, but I would imagine that was a political comment as opposed to an actual policy idea. The earned income tax credit is one of the most effective ways of helping families with low income. But the irony is, it means that we, the taxpayers, are subsidizing low-wage employers, because what it requires is low-wage workers who have children then get a subsidy for the kids. Well, that's fine by me, but I also think that businesses should pay the full cost of business. I'm sort of a fiscal conservative when it comes to that. That businesses should pay their actual cost, and what they need are fed workers, workers who can raise their families, so they ought to raise the wage. Helping people who are on hard times, I totally believe in. But helping employers who can't pay a full wage, that's it. Who claim they can't, and then have profitable businesses, all because, like we were saying at the beginning, they're squeezing out every penny for their shareholders. Hey, that's wrong. Pay your real costs. Care for your workers. That's where you go.
So it's really, in one way, it's good that we have that as a safety net, but at the same time, we are
subsidizing business.
It's sad that there's so many people that qualify for that, because there are so many businesses that aren't paying them a living wage.
Exactly. So it's a business subsidy. So a lot of people think of it as just a handout to this family. No, it's a handout to the business. So let's be real about it. It's a business subsidy. But you know what? It's also a handout to you and me. Because if businesses pay lower wages and they charge lower prices, then I, as a consumer, benefit from the lower price. We all have to change our expectations, where I will pay a just price if people are getting just wages. And so what I've started to do is to, when I go to restaurants especially, oh man, are tipped workers exploited? So I'll go there and ask, you know, what's their wage, what's their hourly wage, and are they getting more? And some places are beginning to pay better wages, And then I'm willing to pay a little bit more for, you know, whatever, a salad or whatever I'm eating. But the thing is I don't want to pay just a little bit more if it goes to that top 1% that marched off into the, you know, into the outside door and down the street. I'll pay a little more if everybody's participating in the benefit. That's where we have to change. That's how this affects the 100%. It's all of us, team.
We wanted to deal a little bit with women's issues. And what is your group doing in terms of seeking equality for women, both in, not just economically, but in general? Because I know United States women are approximately 51 to 52% of the population. So it seems like it would be the reverse, that if women were exercising their power, that the inequality might be against the men. But it's
well, with that, that's a great idea. No, we're about the 100%. But the thing is that women are disproportionately represented at the lower ends of the salary scales. And often, because we don't have support for women in their childbearing years, we don't have good child care, we don't have other supports for women having children, that women then end up not being able to follow their careers. So the things that we're working on right now that affect women is minimum wage is a big one, especially for tipped workers. Like 72% of tipped workers are women. I mean, and they're making $2.13 an hour plus tips. I mean, that's just horrible. Then we're working on paid family leave, paid time off, so that not only for your personal sick time, but also for children, if your child is sick, that you can take some time off. Family-friendly policies that then nourish the family. We say we're a nation of family values, but then work sucks all of the life, energy, and creativity out of people. So we've got to find a better balance that supports the whole family, and that it's not only is it about just every penny of economic benefit, but that how do, as I was saying before, how do corporations care for their workers, because then they'll have better productivity, and that women will benefit. Now, one thing that's really interesting right now is that the majority of students in college and at the graduate level are women. And in medical school, in lawyers, also in management business degrees. And so it's going to be interesting to see if this emerging class of women. And guys aren't going to college. I don't know what's happening. But I've been to a lot of schools where it's like 55% women. And so it's going to be interesting to see, do we have an emerging class of women that are going to be the dominant forces in our society? Stay tuned. We'll see.
In the last question I've got, I want to address a little bit on the right to life.
Uh-huh.
Tell me how you're addressing that with people who are against health care or who favor death penalty, and how you're using the right to life argument to bring them around on that.
Well, I don't know if I bring them around, but this is how I see it, is that I don't think abortion is a good choice. I'm totally in favor of life from conception to natural death. Okay, that's what we say within our faith. But the political consequences of this, some folks have gotten so obsessed by abortion that that's the only thing they care about. And so what I have realized is they're not pro-life. They're only pro-birth. And what our faith calls us to is a pro-life stance that then ensures that everybody has access to health care, to education, to food, shelter, and clothing. I mean, that's the basic. That is a pro-life stance. The death penalty is not in keeping with a pro-life stance. That kills people. That's wrong. That is not in keeping with our faith or our belief in the dignity of each individual. And it makes me, as a citizen, part of the killing team that kills folks. Don't kill in my name. Uh-uh. I'm about life for everyone. Now, the other piece is about this pro-life stance is that I also think that women who choose to have an abortion should be able to do it in a safe, sanitary way. I don't think it's a good choice. I think we should support women so they don't have to make that choice. And what all the evidence shows is that most abortions are not chosen as I mean, there's a few exceptions, but most abortions are not chosen because as a way of contraception. Most abortions are chosen because of economic desperation. And so what we need to do is to support women so they don't have to make that choice. In France, it's a perfect example. France has a much laxer approach to abortion than we do here in the United States. It was actually supported by the bishops, or not opposed by the Catholic bishops of France. But what they felt it was an issue for poverty, because folks could go to Switzerland or Sweden and have abortions. The rich could. But what they needed was open up for all people in France. But you know what? France has a lower abortion rate because women get a year paid leave to care for their child. They have good child care in France. They support women in having kids. It's not the law that's the problem. It's how we don't care of women, take care of our women. And so I say, let's be pro-life. Let's support our women. Let's make sure everybody has access to health care, as the French do. Let's end this senseless killing.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. It was a pleasure to have you.
Great to be with you. Glad it worked.
If you're in Kansas City again, I will invite you back.
Thank you. I hope to come back.
All right.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Now, the calendar for September 29th, 2014. Artesia is a small town in New Mexico where a detention center for women and children opened last summer in response to the influx of undocumented children from Central America. El Centro, the Dream Alliance, and Moore Squared are hosting Outrage from Artesia, Close the Baby Jail. A panel of Kansans share their firsthand accounts from the week they spent volunteering at the Artesia Detention Center. This event is open to the public Thursday, October 2nd, 6 p.m. at the El Centro Academy for Children, 1330 South 30th Street, Kansas City, Kansas. For more information or directions, call El Centro at 913-677-0100. Want to tell the City Council where to go? For the first time, KCMO City Council members and the City's budget staff are inviting residents to provide input on a new 5-year business plan. The input will also help shape the next annual budget. Two identical citizens' workshops are scheduled. The first will be held Wednesday, October 1st, 6 to 8 p.m. at Park Hill School District Administration Building, 7703 Northwest Berry Road, Room 230. That's in KCMO. The second session will be Saturday, October 11th, 9 to 11 a.m., Southeast Community Center, 4201 East 63rd Street in KCMO. Reservations are required to reserve a seat. 54 seats are to be available at each citizen's work session table. Please respond to Susan.Borge, that's B-O-R-G-E, at kcmo.org. That's Susan.Borge at kcmo.org, or call 816-513-6517 today, Monday, September 29th. Additional space will be available for those who wish to attend as observers. The Kansas City Chapter of Missouri Association for Social Welfare's First Friday Forum will focus on human trafficking. Their guest this month will be the U.S. Attorney for the State of Kansas, Barry Grissom, and filmmaker Susan Wolf of Little Wolf Productions. This event is Friday, October 3rd, at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. There is a charge for lunch, which begins at 11:30, but the event itself is open to the public, with the speakers beginning at noon. My name is Jeff Humfeld. These events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. Up next is Report from Behind the Fences with K-Ray, originally broadcast on Sunset Reggae, which can be heard every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. here on KKFI.
This is K-Ray coming to you on KKFI 90.1 with the monthly report from Behind the Fences. This is a segment where we on the inside let you on the outside know what is going on within corrections. And we encourage everyone to get involved with the issues concerning family, friends, and loved ones in prison. The topic for this month is crime victims. These are the people who suffer from the criminal actions of others. The law technically defines a crime victim as the person or persons immediately wronged and extends to their immediate family. Although the legal definition only covers the persons wronged and their immediate families, we know the impact of crime extends much farther than such a limited perspective. In the Impact on Crimes Victims class, which is used in all Missouri prisons to bring awareness to prisoners of their actions, we are taught to see just how far the effects of our actions reach. Being aware of this and our actions obviously promotes the quote-unquote create no more victims motto. This is the foundation of the program, as well as avoiding the get even mentality for prisoners. After being put in prison, we learn suddenly just what the word freedom means. A prisoner sees the effects of not being free as their family and friends make the adjustments as best they can for the prisoner not being able to contribute to society and their families, loss of income such as that. When a judge sentences a person to be committed to prison, with each sentence comes a specified amount of time before the prisoner may be released back to the community. This is referred to as the parole eligibility release date. This is set by the courts when a person is sentenced. In short, a prisoner, the immediate victims, and the prisoner's family, friends, and loved ones know how long they will be gone. The problem is, when the eligibility release date arrives, everyone discovers that it is only a mirage, as the parole board ignores the earliest release date, regardless of the prisoner's conduct record. And, quite often, prisoners who have poor conduct records are chosen for release far more often than prisoners who have good conduct records. The overall effect of these parole board practices are devastating to the communities and the morale within the prisons. Additionally, the horrible torment and hopelessness that families, friends, and loved ones feel when a prisoner...
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
When a prisoner is not sent home at the earliest possible parole eligibility date is terrible. When they left the courthouse, they believed if the convicted person did their time without getting into any more trouble, did what was required of them, that they would be sent home. The parole board is quick to expose all of the lies that were told at the courthouse. If they were not lies when you leave the courthouse, the parole board creates the lie simply by acting as if the prisoners are not eligible to leave prison. Being eligible for release is meaningless to the parole board. Who does this practice benefit? Surely not the community, as nobody can see the future, especially the parole board. Who does this practice harm? Well, obviously the family who has a loved one in prison, as they have waited a long time, which includes so many things. The loss of a family member is devastating under any circumstance, as their love, support, and additional income affect the well-being of the family. Sometimes just being at home means everything to many families. For the parole board to forget this simple fact and treat prisoners' families as if they have also committed crimes just shows how much the board has lost its way as they continue to keep the families apart. Talking to family on the phone or in the visiting room should never become a way of life, as it is only meant to be a temporary solution. There is a point at which the prison system does far more harm than good, as only the parole board can restore families and the communities. To force the families, friends, and loved ones to suffer The enduring pain of a family member being in prison is wrong. Make no mistake, all prisoners know that we put ourselves here, but the parole board chooses to keep us here. That is a very distinct difference. I will close tonight on a personal note, as my brother has finally lost his long battle with depression, and he is dead at 45. I can only think of how life would have been from him and my family had the parole board sent me home when I was eligible to be released in 1996. Needless to say, I know personally how destructive the parole board's decisions are to families. I thank you for listening and encourage you to write into KKFI at P.O. Box 32250, Kansas City, Missouri, 64171, with questions or concerns regarding the issues on this program. Also, you may email Sista G at sunsetreggae@gmail.com. That's SISTAGSUNSETREGGAE@gmail.com. Tonight's program has been dedicated in loving memory of my little brother, Kirk, who is gone but never forgot. This has been K-Ray from Behind the Fences. Take care. God bless. Thank you and good night.
It's the 420 Drug War News, the following, courtesy CBS Denver.
Marijuana is legal here in the state of Colorado, but today hundreds of military veterans received pot free of charge. The unusual event included free medical marijuana and edibles. Organizers designed the event specifically for veterans, but members of the public were also welcome. Our Melissa Garcia is live in downtown Denver near a medical marijuana dispensary. So, Melissa, what was the goal of today's event?
Well, Tom, a handful of Denver area businesses teamed up today to support a budding cause, you could say, to provide military veterans with medical marijuana.
Welcome.
There you go.
Hundreds lined up today to get into the largest event ever hosted by Operation Grow for Vets.
So I've got PTSD, and yeah, I take marijuana that helps me to sleep at night.
Simply place it on the stove?
Also open to the public, Saturday's Denver Cannabis Giveaway handed out 400 bags of marijuana-infused products to military veterans in need.
I'm allergic to morphine and opiates. I can't take them. So I don't have much choice other than do that.
I founded Operation Grow for Vets to try to save some of the veterans who commit suicide and die from drug overdose every day in the United States. So we're going to give away a couple of those.
Grow for Vets founder and executive director Roger Martin, a veteran himself, says this alternative treatment changes lives.
That's our mission, is to offer veterans a safe alternative to the dangerous prescription drugs that they're usually prescribed to deal with PTSD, TBI, chronic pain, and all sorts of other ailments.
There you go.
But some question the safety of giving out this green to the veteran population.
It's a reckless way to operate.
Colorado Smart Approaches to Marijuana Coalition Chair Bob Doyle is calling for more extensive testing and protocol.
These people are getting marijuana with varying degrees of potency and THC that could cause things like paranoia. Things that obviously we wouldn't want somebody, I think, with PTSD to be experiencing.
And Grow for Vets today announced its new Save 1,000 Vets project that aims to get marijuana into the hands of 1,000 veterans with a free lifetime supply of cannabis-infused products. We're live in Denver. Melissa Garcia, CBS 4 News.
A lot of strong opinions on both sides. Thank you, Melissa.
So I've got to ask, just how long should we allow the ignoramuses to run the drug war? Well, that's really up to you.
Darth Drug Czar, you're a coward, a liar, demon, and thief. Seems you can't face the truth for just 1 hour. Too busy looking at peace. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. Sitting here in my prime. What am I gonna do now?
Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Jessica Thomas, host of Before the Dawn on Sunday morning from 4 to 7 a.m. Our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and Eco Radio, KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical. Okay.